Welcome back to the program. In the world of international adoption, market forces have always played a role. The issues of supply and demand impacts both policy and outcomes. But the adoption business, which has long been the province of religious and secular agencies, has lately been overtaken by evangelical advocacy. Evangelical organizations and churches, which have been built upon cultural policies which they oppose, like abortion and gay marriage, now seem to have found a cause they can champion, the cause of adoption. But what are its consequences for the children of the world? We're going to talk about this with my guest, Catherine Joyce. Catherine Joyce is a journalist based in New York. Her work has appeared in Nation, Mother Jones, and The Atlantic. She's a 2011 recipient of the Knight Luce Fellowship for Reporting on Global Religion, and it is my pleasure to welcome her to the program to talk about the child catchers, rescue, trafficking, and the new gospel of adoption. Catherine Joyce, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. Talk a little bit first about the evolution of the Christian adoption movement. Certainly it has always been an area that religious organizations have had a role in, been part of, but certainly what's happened in the past several years has changed remarkably.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we've seen a traditional association of adoption with the abortion debate. I think for years this has been presented, adoption has been presented as kind of quick and easy solution to a fight that's been going on, obviously, in this country for decades now. But in the last few years, we've seen evangelicals, you know, many of whom are approaching it from that anti-abortion or pro-life position, start to broaden their reasons for why they're getting involved in adoption. We've seen the rise of what they call adoption theology or orphan theology, an argument that earthly adoption mirrors the spiritual adoption that Christians undergo, their experience of salvation by God, that they need to then act out by adopting children just as God has adopted them. But I think more than that, maybe it's just that a lot of evangelicals want to be for something. I think many evangelicals have become tired with only being known for being opposed to gay marriage, for being opposed to abortion rights or maybe contraception in some of those circles. And this was something that they could do that is really enthusiastically positive. So we started seeing what they themselves describe as a contagious or a viral adoption culture growing in churches where, you know, churches might adopt as many as 100 children or several hundred children in a few years as pastors are modeling this, and many of the people in the congregation are following suit.
To what extent has this grown up as part of an attempt on the part of a lot of evangelical churches to get back to some of its social justice roots?
Well, I think a number of the leaders that I spoke to referenced that specifically. In the mid-20th century, there was a big noticeable divide between Christians who would later become either fundamentalists or evangelicals, the conservative side of the religion, and then the more mainline Protestant branches, which were focused more on good works and the social gospel. So I think a lot of evangelicals felt that they had unfairly been made to choose between following doctrine strictly and doing good works. They felt that they wanted to combine both of those things and to reclaim some of that territory. So among them, you will hear people saying this adoption movement is not a new movement, but it's a return to our biblical foundation.
And talk about some of the organizations that have sprung up in this area and the way in which they have spread internationally and the other organizations internationally that they have linked up with.
Right. Well, the largest group, a sort of umbrella group for all of the hundreds of ministries, adoption ministries and orphan care ministries that have sprung up the last few years, a lot of them are grouped under the Christian Alliance for Orphans, which just had its 9th annual summit in Nashville this year. And so every year, thousands of people will come to this summit, and most of them are either church leaders or leaders of some of these hundreds of ministries that promote adoption through crisis pregnancy centers or that help raise money for prospective adoptive parents who would like to follow in their church's example and adopt a child. These ministries will help them raise money. So a lot of them will gather at the Christian Alliance for Orphans Summit. There are also other groups like Together for Adoption is a big one. Some of the larger churches have significant ministries on their own. Saddleback Church out there in California has been an early leader in this, and they have a large adoption and orphan care program that I think has witnessed more than 500 children adopted within their congregation, but also models an orphan ministry, an adoption ministry for other churches to follow.
And part of what you hear when you hear this being talked about is the way in which these churches think that they're, or talk about that they're saving souls twice, that in a sense that it's saving souls and spreading the gospel at the same time.
Yeah, that is probably not the first motivation for most people who are adopting. I think most people who are adopting first want to grow their families, and second feel like they're doing something humanitarian. But if you read the books on adoption theology and orphan theology that are helping spread this movement so far and wide, you will see that there is a recurrent focus that adoption is being compared to missionary work being the traditional way that Christians spread the gospel, that people are saying, as one leader wrote, as important as it is to find a child a home, what's even more important is helping get that child into a Christian home so they'll be exposed to the gospel and the world can see us doing this. So there is a sort of secondary motivation that you're not just saving a child physically, but you're also saving a child spiritually.
To what extent has this taken place here in the U.S.? To what extent is it a domestic issue as well as an international one, which we'll obviously talk about?
Well, that's how I started looking at this, was looking at the growth of rhetoric in some anti-abortion ministries, some called crisis pregnancy centers that hope to stop women from choosing abortion and instead get them to choose to continue the pregnancy. A lot of them will not stop there, but will also encourage women to choose adoption, arguing that life with a single mother is not God's plan for the family or for a child, and that it's a more selfless and more mature decision to give the child up for adoption. And for some women, that might be the right decision, but I also spoke with an awful lot of women who encountered that sort of message from crisis pregnancy centers as deeply coercive. I think this is particularly a problem for women coming from religious backgrounds who might be more vulnerable to the sort of arguments that crisis pregnancy centers make, that this is not God's plan, that God wants you to bless another family by giving up your child for adoption. So there have been multiple manuals actually written about this by some of the conservative Christian groups out there, like the Family Research Council, arguing how can we convince more women to relinquish for adoption, because contrary to popular opinion, there are actually not many infants available for domestic adoption in the United States. That number is way down. There are far more would-be adoptive parents hoping to adopt than there are babies available for adoption. So we've seen kind of the proliferation of these ministries that are trying to figure out how they can convince more women with unexpected pregnancies to give that child for adoption instead.
And this is the way much of this has spread internationally to places initially like Guatemala.
Yeah, well, we see a similar dynamic there. It probably sounds crass to a lot of listeners to think in terms of supply and demand, but unfortunately, that is the way the adoption field, and if you will, the adoption industry, has become set up, as there are just many more would-be adoptive parents in line for a certain type of child. So while there are children available for adoption, overwhelmingly the demand is for young and healthy children, babies if possible. And there aren't as many babies out there who are healthy available for adoption as there are prospective adoptive parents in the U.S. and Europe. And so this leads to a sort of a crush on the supply side, and in some developing countries, this has led to the rise of people functioning as what you can only call child finders, people who will go out in developing countries. This happened in Guatemala, and after Guatemala shut down, this happened in Ethiopia most recently, and now it's happening in countries like Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. People who are going out into poor communities and recruiting children for adoption, sometimes by misrepresenting what adoption is to the biological families. In Africa, there is a different tradition of adoption, and so when we go over there as Westerners and present adoption, sometimes these families think that they are sending their child away for education in the U.S. and that the child will then return some years later and be able to help the family. Some families who are very destitute think that they are setting themselves up for some sort of arrangement like a sponsorship where the family is going to be receiving financial support from the adoptive family. So there are a lot of factors in this that can result in adoption being treated much more as a business than the humanitarian child welfare institution it should be.
You talk about Guatemala, the amount of money that was flowing into the country as a direct result of this, in addition to women, pregnant women being paid in many cases.
Yeah, that did happen in some cases. In some cases, there were even alleged kidnappings of children from willing and present biological mothers whose babies were fetching a high price on the international adoption market. International adoptions are quite expensive. Most people are probably pretty aware with that, but they can range from $25,000 up until $60,000. This is a huge amount here, but it's an even larger sum when it's in a developing country. What this money can lead to, if child finders there, if adoption lawyers, if other middlemen who get involved in brokering these deals can make a comparatively vast sum of several thousand dollars for facilitating an adoption, if that's something that is much higher than the average annual income in a country like Guatemala or Ethiopia, obviously it gives a lot of incentive for corruption to happen.
What brought an end to it in Guatemala? It really changed dramatically. Talk a little about that.
Well, there were just mounting stories of corruption and fraud. In some cases, as I said, there was actual kidnapping. There was a wonderful book on that called Finding Fernanda that traced one child who was kidnapped from her mother in Guatemala and offered for adoption to a family in the U.S. who luckily realized that something wasn't right and the adoption was not completed. But other children, some children were taken away from families. In some rural communities where this had happened more than once, there became such a stigma that there were attacks on Western visitors who came through. They were being suspected of being there to traffic in the region's poor children. In other cases, women were being offered nominal payments in order to relinquish for adoption. There were accusations of some serious things that were going wrong. In the end, they started conducting DNA tests to make sure that the women posing as mothers to relinquish children for adoption were actually the mothers, but the people who were involved in the criminal adoptions in Guatemala, which of course is not all of the adoptions that occurred there, but the people who were doing wrong there found a way around the DNA tests as well, manipulating the actual mothers into going and performing that test under false pretenses. So there just was a real kind of Wild West atmosphere of anything goes. And on the other side, this is of course being presented to U.S. prospective adoptive parents as something that they're doing that is saving an orphaned child, a child that has no one in the world. So really, people were getting hurt on all sides of this issue.
How did it move from Guatemala to Ethiopia as a center of this activity?
Well, that's something we see time and again. Adoption, international adoption, focuses frequently as a boom and bust industry. So you'll see a tremendous boom in one country. In Guatemala, at its height, one in every 100 children was going overseas for international adoption. And then when that slowed down, the agencies that were working there suddenly had their cash flow cut off. A lot of them could not function without a steady stream of children and the adoption fees that went with that. So some of them shut down, but some of them shifted their focus to another country. And a number of them went to Guatemala, which was not a country that had signed on to the Hague Convention on Intercountry Adoption, which is a standard meant to protect against adoption corruption. So there they found a country where they could operate without having to adhere to these rules, without having to become accredited themselves. So we actually saw some of the same agencies just hopping over to another country and setting up the same thing. And you know, the same sorts of problems arose there. One of the adoption agency's directors, and this was from a reputable agency, told me that in the early days, before they had systems set up, some brokers, some finders, were being paid $5,000 to identify a child who could go abroad for adoption. Considering that most Ethiopians make $500 a year, getting $5,000 for this one recommendation, you can see how quickly this would lead to a proliferating industry of people going out to identify children to go abroad for adoption. And if you have Western demand specifying that people want young, healthy baby girls, then you can see how this leads into a system that is not about protecting the best interests of children.
One of the points that you touched on before is what adoption means in different places and what the context is. Ethiopia being an example of that, where this sense of adoption being forever in the context of Western understanding was very different.
Absolutely. In a number of countries, there is a tradition like adoption, maybe not exactly what we think. We think of our understanding of adoption as being universal, but in Ethiopia, it's more of a guardianship system where I might send my child to my wealthier brother or to a family friend so that they'll have better opportunities for education, for getting set up in life, and that they can then come back and help the entire family. So this is much more the cultural tradition in a number of countries. This was also the case in Liberia, where I looked. And you have these people who are almost excited to relinquish a child for adoption. And you would see this time and time again in some of the relinquishment videos that adoption agencies here in the U.S. would make as they went around in rural communities in Ethiopia and were talking with biological families who were offering their children for adoption. And you would see some of these mothers smiling as they were talking about it. And I think that's should be a serious indication that there's a disconnect between what we see as adoption here and what these women and fathers as well, what these families think that they're agreeing to. I also spoke with Ethiopian families who thought that they had sent their children for education for a few years, that they would be back by the time that they were 18. So there's just a massive disconnect that needs to be addressed if we're going to have ethical adoptions.
Talk a little bit about what's going on in Rwanda, which is a step in the improvement area.
Absolutely. I went to Rwanda thinking that I was going to witness the next adoption boom country. Ethiopia was starting to slow down in 2011, and Rwanda has a heavy presence of U.S. evangelicals who are involved in mission and ministry work there in many ways. It's really a country with a uniquely high level of American involvement, including a very sizable presence from Saddleback Church, who have been leaders in the adoption movement. What I was actually interested to find was that things in Rwanda were not proceeding according to the same script that's happened in Guatemala, in Ethiopia, in Vietnam, in Cambodia, and many other adoption boom countries. In Guatemala, the government leaders had gone to visit Ethiopia, which is a close neighboring country, and did not like what they had seen of what adoption had brought in that country, and they very vehemently did not want the same thing to happen in Rwanda. After the genocide, Rwanda is actually an extremely kind of orderly and bureaucratic society, so there were also a lot more institutions in place to provide the sort of oversight that is necessary to keep adoption from becoming a sort of Wild West free-for-all that it becomes in some other less stable countries. So there in Rwanda, the government was keeping adoption to a very low and very tightly overseen process, a very low number and a tightly overseen process. And the Christian missionaries that were working there in the U.S. were actually behaving differently than some of their counterparts have in other countries. A lot of people from Saddleback and other just independent churches were working hand in hand with the government there to work on local solutions that would address more appropriately the needs of poor children and vulnerable children in Rwandan society. Rwanda's government wanted to set up more domestic alternatives to international adoption, so they wanted to set up their own foster care system and to work on family reunification. So two things that would keep a lot of children who would otherwise potentially be slated for overseas adoption, to keep them within Rwandan culture and hopefully to reunite them with families that might have placed them in orphanages just because of poverty and could care for them with a little more support.
One of the points you make with respect to Ethiopia and even Rwanda to a certain extent is the dramatic difference between kids that are in rural areas versus those that are in urban settings.
Right. Well, if travelers go to the capital of Ethiopia, and to some extent some places in Rwanda as well, you're likely to see a lot of street children. And that would certainly, of course, understandably, affect a lot of people and make them think these children are in need of help and perhaps these children should be adopted overseas. However, one of the things I found is that those street children that I saw in Ethiopia are almost unilaterally not going to go abroad for adoption. They are almost, by virtue of their status as street children, unqualified to enter the system that would allow them to be adopted overseas. So there's another disconnect there between the very real number of children who are potentially in need of new parents and an adoptive family and could benefit from international adoption, and the children who often end up going for international adoption. It's easier to do the paperwork for a child who has been relinquished by their parents to an orphanage and then be sent overseas than it is to determine whether or not a street child who does not have any paperwork, who does not have this neat paper trail, to determine whether or not they are eligible. So there's that system, that reality ends up contributing to the system whereby more people, child finders and agencies in countries like Ethiopia will seek to identify children for adoption who already live with poor families, because there you can get the relinquishment papers, you can have that signed off by the local police and get things moving towards adoption. Whereas, with some of the street children, it's much more difficult to know. So it's kind of an apples and oranges of what children are in need of help and which are actually going for adoption.
What has been the role of organizations like UNICEF and other international NGOs?
Well, groups like UNICEF are often tarred, I think unfairly maligned, as though they are anti-adoption, as though they are standing in the way of more international adoptions happening. That's certainly been a strong message that some of the people involved in the evangelical adoption movement have made, seeing UNICEF as this enemy. But I think what UNICEF and other groups like Save the Children have tried to do instead is to emphasize that this is an incredibly complicated, complex problem, that children in orphanages are not necessarily children who do not have parents. Sometimes the children go, their parents will come and visit them every day in some orphanages in Haiti and other countries. So they have tried to increase that understanding that, adoption and children in orphanages and the whole infrastructure of child care in the developing nation is a very, very complicated question. But what they've also been doing in a number of countries like Ethiopia and Rwanda, is working with the government on a program of deinstitutionalization, which is trying to get children out of orphanages. There's a truism that one UNICEF worker in Ethiopia told me, that if you build an orphanage, it is going to be filled. Because if you're building an orphanage in a poor rural area and there's suddenly a new shiny orphanage that provides education and two or three meals a day, that is probably going to look like a nice alternative for some families who are really struggling to provide those basics to their families. But then all of a sudden you have children in these orphanages where institutions, research has shown time and time again, institutions can do significant damage to children's development. So it's, another one of these instances where very good intentions are leading to potentially harmful outcomes. So UNICEF, along with a number of country governments and sometimes in cooperation with other ministries and nonprofits, are going and trying to figure out why each child is in an institution in the number of countries where they're doing this program, and seeking to place the child in a family setting according to a prioritized list of options. hopefully first reuniting them with their parents, or if not that, the extended family, and moving down the line with international adoption as a last option after domestic alternatives and family alternatives within the country have been sorted through.
Where do adoptions in Asia fit into this equation, or do they?
Well, I mean, a lot of adoptions for the past 10, 15 years came from China.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that started at a time when there were many, many children in need of adoption, many girls particularly. I think most people are aware of the one-child policy in China and the impact that had on girl children born in that country. But that number has slowed dramatically. I think the last number I heard about Chinese adoptions was that there was maybe a six-year wait time for new adoptive parents who are signing up for that process. So in China, as in other countries, there simply aren't the same number of infant children available for adoption, and the infant children, especially infant girls, have long been the children most in demand for international adoption. So what adoption in China has shifted to instead is mostly special needs adoption. So I think there's less of a wait time to adopt special needs. But a number of factors have fed into this. For one, China's economy has grown, obviously, in the last 10 years, and there is now domestic adoption demand within China. So there's a lot of Chinese families that would like to adopt infants from their own country. And that is prioritized under law, as it should be. So it's just a dramatic shift. But what that means for agencies that have been working there or focusing most on there is that even if they're nonprofits, the source of the revenue that keeps them operating is beginning to decline. So we're seeing worldwide this constriction of the international adoption market as numbers of children coming to the U.S. have dropped by, I think, 60% in the last 10 years.
Is there anything specifically that should be done either domestically in terms of public policy here or internationally that should and can reform some of these unsavory aspects of all these practices?
Well, the Hague Adoption Convention has helped some. The U.S. is a signatory to that. However, the way we implemented it left some pretty large loopholes. One of the biggest loopholes that it left is that agencies that are not Hague accredited can still do business, but also that agencies are allowed to continue adopting from countries that have not joined the Hague. So Ethiopia was a country that had not joined the Hague, so a lot of agencies were doing significant numbers of adoptions from a country that has not agreed to abide by the same rules governing ethical adoptions. I think I don't have the number at my fingertips, but it's a majority of the adoptions that come into the U.S. are from countries that have not joined The Hague. So if we have this standard of ethical adoptions that a number of agencies have agreed to, it's almost a moot point if the partner country has not signed on to the same rules. There are some other loopholes in that also could be tightened. I think agencies here in the U.S. are not held responsible for what their partners overseas do, and considering that a lot of the ethical problems start at a very local level with paperwork for children being forged or altered unethically at a local level, that's something that then goes up through the entire federal system of a country like Ethiopia and governs whether or not that adoption is permissible. So there are ways that could be strengthened, but I also think on a civilian level, what a lot of people here in the U.S. could do is to look more closely at these issues and to understand that our demand as, you know, comparatively much wealthier people going to some of these developing nations, our demand has a distorting effect on how child welfare and the child care infrastructure is working in these countries. So we need to understand our own role in this system more and then take some serious steps to protect against participating in an unethical system.
Catherine Joyce, the book is The Child Catchers, Rescue, Trafficking, and the New Gospel of Adoption. It's just out from Public Affairs. Catherine, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I appreciate it. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.